This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington, catching up with Jason Graves. And oh my gosh, it's so much fun to have a chance to talk to you again.
It's been a while. It's wonderful to virtually see you.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And we've got something so cool to talk about, your soundtrack for the new Dark Pictures anthology, Little Hope, which is set in my neck of the woods in Massachusetts, in this really creepy, ooh, abandoned, spooky town. So I've just really, really been enjoying the music, and it's going to be fun to kind of, I don't know, just sort of, you know, dive in and pull it apart and look under the hood. And what were some of the things that the devs at Supermassive Games gave you to work with initially, so you could, I don't know, start, you know, designing what the music should sound like?
I think the very first thing that I did was just on a conversation that I had with Barney Pratt, who's the audio director there. This is the this was the third game we had worked on together. And he just mentioned it in passing. Well, the next one we're going to be doing, Salem, you know, witch trials sort of a thing, that sort of a time period. Just wanted to plant the seed or something like that. And he did the same thing with Man of Medan. And I just thought, that sounds really interesting. And then, of course, in the back of my brain, stuff started percolating, and I started thinking about what cool opportunities for sound there would be if it was a period game like that, that took place like centuries ago, you know, not even early 1900s. I mean, like late 1600s. Is that right?
Yeah.
I think that's right. Like a long time ago. And I started thinking about, well, you know, it's always for me, especially if I'm doing something scary, what can I do that's going to be super effective for the game? That's the number one question. But number two is, what can I do that makes it different and sets itself apart from maybe something that I've done that's scary before? And that combination of those two things is what kind of yields the best fruit I've found. So I'm sure that you've noticed this in listening to the score. Actually, I'm going to stop. What sort of things did you notice listening to the score that maybe sounded a little bit different or turned your ear and you thought, oh, wait, this is not what I expected, or this is a little unusual?
Well, what really struck me about it is it's a smaller ensemble, it sounds like, and there are some really kind of elemental sounds. It's like the strings have a kind of a raw quality to them, and then there's the metallic sound of the dulcimer and the hurdy-gurdy that has a kind of a, I don't know, a weird sort of handcrafted sound to it. And it sounds like, you know, 17th century New England.
Well, I don't think I could have scripted that answer for you better. That's great, Kate. You should consider doing something like this for a living.
Okay, yeah, that's a great idea.
You hit the nail on the head, though, because it was like, I was looking around, you know, we had the same conversation for Moss, which was this little forest game with a tiny little mouse and all these little creatures. And I was looking around my studio and looking in my collection of instruments and thinking, what do I have that's tiny and small that sounds like it could be played by a mouse? Well, for this, I was looking around thinking, what do I have that looks like it's in disrepair, it's out of tune, it only has a couple of strings on it, or it's something that could have been built, you know, hundreds of years ago and used for music. Because a lot of that just directly translates to the kind of visuals and emotional core of this particular game, because you're in that time period, you're seeing the setting with the cool visuals and all the fog and the kind of period costumes and everything. So it was definitely like, choose those instruments, go as live as possible, use as few instruments as possible, and try to make it almost like nursery rhyme-ish. That kind of like do-do-do, just real simple sing-song, childlike sort of thing was taken from the perspective of the little girl in the game, who is sort of central to the story, but also a lot revolves around her and how she's seen by the other characters. So I like the idea of having almost a nursery rhyme for the theme.
there's a moment where you hear the Ring Around the Rosie song. I don't think it's in the soundtrack, but it's in the game. And it's in this really kind of creepy, creepy version because she's sort of appearing out of the dark. And the characters that are living in like the now time, the college students and their professor, some of them see her. And that's such a great trigger because it instantly has this kind of, kids can be creepy sometimes with their weird little games and their imagination and stuff. And so that was a really, really cool effect.
It was happenstance, actually, because I was thinking of some sort of a sing-songy nursery rhyme theme. And then within a couple of weeks, Barney sent me their test pieces from that Ring Around a Rosie, where she's super British and she's also kind of affecting that maybe Puritan sort of time period dialogue. And it was definitely like, wow, that is really creepy. And it just like double ensured that I felt like that was the right direction for the score, was to center it around a female voice and make it sort of, let's face it, nursery rhymes are creepy.
Yeah, they are. Well, that one especially, it's about the plague, so, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So how did you get started? I mean, one of the things that's interesting about this soundtrack is there's not like a main theme that you can like really latch onto. So how did you get started?
Well, ironically, I started with a main theme.
Oh, well, I must have missed it.
But, well, no, it's not something that is prevalent throughout the game. There was definitely a decision made early on my part, mostly, and I love it when things like this happen, mostly because I couldn't really play, you know, the hurdy-gurdy or the bowed psaltery or the dulcimer. Like, none of them are necessarily the most musical unless you're trying to do like an authentic Celtic thing or, you know, something a little more true to the instruments period in history. It's not like I could do an expressive, creepy sort of theme that would be able to recur throughout the game. And it didn't seem like it needed it. It seemed like textures and kind of being cold and out of tune and the more desolate kind of the musical landscape, the more it fit this virtually empty town that the characters are kind of exploring throughout most of the game.
Yeah, you know, what's so interesting about it is it in a way, there are elements of it that remind me of Silent Hill, because the characters have to walk through the fog in the dark. They don't know where they're going. And so the audio and the music do a lot of the heavy lifting for the atmosphere. And in fact, you've even got a track on the soundtrack called Impenetrable Fog, and it has all of these layers and like a lot of atmosphere. It's really, really cool. Not a
it
question
it was definitely
there,
just sort of a cool, oh, no, I appreciate that, because it was a lot of fun. It was fun trying to come up with textures and the kinds of sounds that were evocative just by the way they sounded. Like you mentioned the hurdy-gurdy, that's the kind of thing that it's a box with a little handle on it, almost like an organ grinder for a monkey. So you're spinning this handle and it's bowing the strings. And just mine was a very inexpensive one, because you have to wait 3-4 years if you want a good hurdy-gurdy. There's only a few people in the world that make the actual, like the real proper instruments. But that's okay, because I wasn't trying to play a Celtic, you know, pirate song or something like that. I needed that raspy, like, you know, stick my fingernail in there and bend the pitch a little bit so it's kind of grinding and doing all those things that basically make everyone in the house leave the studio, because it's just such an unpleasant sound. But when you record it and you put it in there with some reverb, and then I play some other things and kind of end up soundscaping with the score, it's like an immediate reaction, right? When you hear it, it's very visceral the way kind of your brain reacts to it. But it's also thin and out of tune, and it works for the history of the game. Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. And it's got this kind of raw sort of scrapey sound with the way that, you know, it makes the sound. And it works so well with the creepy little twig figure that's supposed to ward away the devil. It's just that there's a primitive quality to all of this that just like really, really works. And so how did you find the hurdy-gurdy? I mean, I know you can get anything on the internet, but is that how you tracked it down?
Yeah, on the internet somewhere. There was someone in the western part of the U.S., I think, that makes them. And they're fairly inexpensive, all things considered. And as far as a beginner's hurdy-gurdy goes, it's fantastic. I completely abused it and played it wrong and tuned it wrong and didn't do what you were supposed to do with the strings, but I was treating it more as sound design. So thankfully, there were things like that, the bowed psaltery and the hammered dulcimer and a couple of other instruments that I could order and get within like 4 to 6 weeks and then start experimenting with them. And the tuning, especially, a lot of it was... It's almost like I was recording this back when that game kind of mostly takes place, because I really use the computer as a tape machine more than, you know, nowadays, even this interview that we're doing, right? You're going to have to go in and you're going to have to edit where my microphone dropped out, and you're going to have to balance my voice with your voice, right? And get everything and punch in the music edits and do stuff like that. And that's how music is normally assimilated as well in the computer. But for this, I would just do a single take. I would practice whatever it is I was doing a couple of times, and then I would just record a single take. And whatever that take was, that's what I kept. And that's the length of the cue, basically. So a lot of it, if it's a 4 or 5 minute cue, I'm just playing for you know, 3 or 4 minutes. And then I pick up another instrument and I play that instrument based on what the first one was doing. And it's like a band, but it's just me. So I'm not doing any edits. I'm not using anything in the computer, no EQ, no compressors. I wanted it to be really raw and to sound like, you know, 5 or 6 people in a room. And then I'm basically just pointing at them and going, go. And then they play the song, right? That was the intent, at least.
Well, and what's cool about that is, you know, in early New England, there weren't a lot of really, really fabulous musicians. I mean, there were some, and they would go from town to town and teach the people in the town how to do, like, shape note singing. I mean, you know this, but the people who lived in the town weren't great musicians, and so that must have given you a little bit of, I don't know, latitude to not play these things like a professional.
Definitely. And I kind of thought that it was going to be silly and it was going to sound stupid and that it would just sound bad. But a lot of it, honestly, the tuning and everything, not being in tune or being intentionally a little out of tune was all great until I had this main theme track that my youngest daughter sings on. She's got really good pitch, and I was just playing a piano sample for her to give her her cue for the notes to sing, and she was singing really in tune. But then when I played it all back, like the next day, it sounded like really off. But I realized that my dulcimer, it's this big grand dulcimer, and it's just doing lots of little bling 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 kind of things. But the whole entire dulcimer was basically like almost like a quarter step flat, because it had been tuned probably for Moss like a year and a half earlier, but it had just drifted slowly flat, but it was in tune with itself. And the problem was your brain thought the dulcimer was in tune, and then it sounds like Mally's singing sharp the whole entire time. So I did have to go, and I took the whole dulcimer track and just pitched it up by about a quarter step. And then everything else was kind of out of tune, you know, a little sharp, a little flat, or just not tuned to anything whatsoever. And then that was the winning combo, you know, tuning the drums to get in the right key. Everything was done live, which was cool. It was really fun. It was very liberating, honestly, just to do something and then be like, okay, I'm not going to do anything else to it. That's a little sloppy. It came in a little late. I'm just going to leave it.
Wow. Yeah, because that gives it a handcrafted quality, and it makes it sound alive, because, you know, lots of people, and I know you do this too, you can make everything perfect, but it can kind of suck the life out of it in a way. And so it must have been really fun to have your daughter working on this too.
It was. She took a little bit of convincing, but it was amazing, because she just sang it all, and she's like, "How was that?" And I was like, "That was great. Let's just do one more." And she goes, "Okay." And she goes and sings it again. And I was still recording, and I said, "Okay, can you just do like some just creepy like children?" And she goes, "I was like, yeah, do stuff like that." So she did some creepy whispering real quick, and then we laughed about it. And then I said, "Now do your stupidest kind of ghost like woo kind of thing," and she did a little bit of that. And I ended up taking the creepy whispers are actually used at a couple of very specific places in the game, because Barney sent me some game captures, and it was great because you can just hear her. It's obviously, I know it's my kid, but no one else would know that. And the ghost sounds I actually did put into the computer, and I played them on the keyboard. So a lot of the background, you might not even realize it's a vocal actually, but there's all these background textures of just slowly bending pitches, and that's Mally singing. And then just me literally taking like a single note that she sang and stretching it out to be 20 seconds long, and then I'm doing a little pitch bend on the keyboard. So it's kind of the antithesis of everything else that I was doing with all the other instruments. But I like that almost supernatural sound of a voice kind of going with the other very period, very raw, organic kinds of instruments. And it gave me a lot of good, like, creepy pads and textures and things to work with.
Yeah, because one of the things that I really appreciate about the music is the various layers. And even though you can identify some of them, yeah, like her voice and what you did with it just there, is it's kind of inidentifiable. And now I know why, because it's just not a natural thing. So
she did this one thing. She did this like this just little slow bend. And then she giggled and laughed. I was like, "That was really cool. Can you do that again?" And it ends up that if you stretch that out to maybe four times as long, and I'm playing it on the keyboard, and like you reach down on these really low notes on the keyboard, and it's like this, oh, I mean, this really breathy, like scary sounding thing, and then it slowly starts pitch bending, and then you hit a key up higher and you hear this, and it was like half the score was written right there, with me literally spending like 2 minutes just cutting up her samples real quick while she sat there and watched, and me throwing them into Kontakt, which is a program that we use so you can play things on a keyboard, and just messing with them a little bit. And it was like, wow, okay, so that's going to be a big part of the score. Thanks, honey.
Does she have her union card yet? I mean, did you have to pay her?
Fortunately, no, she does not. So I think she works for hugs, mm-hmm, and snuggles.
Uh-huh. That sounds like a good arrangement for now, anyway.
Yes, definitely.
Well, I could hear her and some of those creepy voices in that track, The Devil's Grasp. And it starts with this sting, like a jump scare kind of thing. And there's a lot of percussion in there, too. And so that must have been fun to kind of, you know, open the throttle with your drumming skills.
Yeah, it was cool to have the percussion sounds bigger, you know, than a lot of that score. It's very minimal. So when it comes in, it kind of takes over the space in the queue, but it's actually not that many instruments. There's just a couple of like some big clicky clacky kind of bamboo, like cha 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 kind of things, and a drum that you sit on when you play. And it's cool because it's got a crank inside of it, so you can tune it to any pitch you want. So that way I was able to tune it to sort of like, if we're in D, I'm able to tune the drum to D or A or something like that. And then just some other little shakers and things like that I have to be always really careful, because probably half the percussion I have came from doing this game Far Cry Primal like 5 years ago or something like that. And it can be really easy to just, when you're thinking like, I want something old, I don't want it to be modern, I want it to sound like archaic and kind of crusty, and there's about 15 things that I could have grabbed. So I was really careful to be selective and not pick those same kinds of instruments. Like if I had used a death whistle, like an Aztec death whistle, if you're familiar with Far Cry Primal, you would have been like, oh wait, this kind of sounds like Far Cry Primal. And that's of course the antithesis of what I want to do. So I paint myself into a corner sometimes, because I don't want to have one thing harkening back to another one. But I'm also walking around, I'm looking for physical instruments in this room with all these shelves of things and trying to think like, can I use that? No, that was on so-and-so. Well, how about this? And even the dulcimer that I use, that's the first time I've gotten it out. There's this real raspy, like, when it kind of goes up and down in pitch a little bit. I do some tremolo stuff on it. I haven't used that since Tomb Raider, because I did that same kind of thing on Tomb Raider a lot. It was a big part of the scavenger sound for that score, and that came out in 2013. So I guess it was like 2019, and I was like, okay, it's been long enough. It's going to be tuned differently. I don't even remember what I did on that game. Hopefully this will be a different interpretation, and people are going to go, wow, it sounds just like Tomb Raider.
That's an interesting way of approaching it, though, because I would imagine you've got things that are sort of your go-to instruments in your, you know, your battery of percussion or your string samples or that kind of thing. But to get out of it on purpose, get out of your comfort zone and make sure that you're using different things must be kind of a fun adventure.
Sure, we could say it's a fun adventure. It's usually me slapping myself and going, duh. Or I'll be, you know, I'll be an hour into doing something and one of my kids will come and go and they go, oh, wow, that sounds just like, and they'll say some game that I've worked on before. And I'm like, okay, so we're not going to use that instrument.
Uh-huh.
Because it's easy enough to swap out for a different instrument.
Sure.
And the instruments are what really provide a lot of the, like the impetus behind the music itself. If I'm playing a hurdy-gurdy, obviously, you know, turning that crank and the tension on the strings and which ones you're using and muting them and bending them with your fingers, that's going to be completely different than, you know, if I'm clicking on a keyboard in the computer and I've, you know, I'm in this cool sound pack of medieval sounds. Oh, here's hurdy-gurdy 1, 2, or 3. You know, which one do I want to use? I've always been, I think because I'm a drummer, just about the tangible.
Mm-hmm.
What can I hit or smack or bow or get someone to sing that is interesting and unique for this project?
Right. Yeah. Well, what's so cool, one of the things that is, I think, really interesting about this game is that it's set in, seems like, three different time periods, because there's the modern, you know, like the now time group of the college students and their professor that have gotten stranded because their bus has crashed. But before that, when the game starts out, there's this sort of middle period with a family with a girl who's got some issues and the house catches on fire. And the prologue, the music that you wrote for that prologue is just terrifying. So how did you, where did that all come from?
Oh, I'm glad you think so. That was one of the, actually, I think that was the very last thing we did for the music. A lot of times you've got cinematics and things that just come online at the last minute. And I think I saw the movie before I actually talked with Barney. And I remember thinking, everything we've done for this game is completely inappropriate for this scene. It's just not going to work. There's all kinds of conversations that happen, especially with a game that has as many sort of time layers as this one does. You know, how do you address certain things chronologically or linearly, or is it based on a character? There was a lot of back and forth, but I was almost all the time just kind of planting my feet and politely suggesting we stick to the old sounding music. Just stick to that, because as soon as you start vacillating between making something old and then making it new and then making it in the middle, and you open up this whole other can of worms. If we stick to the old stuff, even if you use it in the quote-unquote modern day time, you're alluding to that older period. Like it'll just work, and it'll keep everything like a symmetry in terms of the style. And then at the very end, this scene came in and I was like, well, we're going to have to do something completely different. But it was one of those things that it was such a cool scene and we knew it was the prologue and it was so over the top that I basically just threw out the rule book and used, you know, the full orchestra with the choir, with the percussion, with the kind of big modern like trailer sort of sounds and stuff, and just went for broke and kind of did, like, you know, pedal to the metal. Just big energy, lots of changing, it was a lot of fun to do, but I was concerned that it was so big that everyone at Supermassive would be like, yeah, it doesn't really work with the game though, does it? But that's every composer thinks that, like every day they write something, but they loved it. And it ended up like just really being a really fun way to wrap up the production. It's like I'd been kind of with my arms tied behind my back and you know, one microphone that doesn't record things very well, and I'm kind of kicking instruments around trying to make a score, and then they sort of unleashed everything and said, go for it, you can use all your sounds and do anything you want. We just want it to be really big and epic and over the top and scary and nerve-wracking and like everything at the same time. It was a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, it sounds like it must have been, because it, yeah, over the top is a great way of describing it, because it's like those horror movies that I try not to watch because they're really scary, but you just know that something terrible is going to happen. And having the choir in there just adds to the terror and the weight of this terrible fire that's taken hold of the house. And what text are they singing? Or are they even singing a text?
It's just syllables.
Oh, yeah.
Like it's just random, you know, syllables that when thrown together sound like something other than ooh or ah, you know, so they could be chanting in some language from the 17th century, who knows?
Because it sounds, you know, almost but not quite like Latin, and, you know, who knows with those witch trials, who knows what kind of language they were chanting to ward off the evil spirits, or they were the evil spirits. We just don't even know. So,
right.
Well, it must be an interesting process to do what's going to end up being the first thing people hear in a game, to write that last. Is that something that normally happens?
You know, it's one of those things that I don't remember enough about the production, if that was planned from the beginning, and maybe it just came online at the end when they were finishing, or maybe they decided that they needed to have a prologue to kind of tease out some things. Honestly, I can't remember, but it does happen often, I should say. It's interesting because looking back, I do remember a little bit about doing that, mostly because I was scoring to picture, because it's very precise in the timing of things. I mean, it's a good 5 to 7 minute scene. So as opposed to most of Little Hope, where I'm just kind of unspooling ideas over a 5 or 6 minute cue that are just like you're exploring in the fog, for example, I'll just do whatever comes to mind. This was very specifically lined up with all the different events in the prologue as they occur in real time, and the music has to be able to react, and in a big way, right? There's a lot, it's a huge orchestra, plus all the synths and the choir and everything else. So in a way, I sort of fell back to my roots because I'm from a film scoring, TV music kind of background. And I very much felt like I was sort of back in like the Swamp Thing, which I did this TV show last year, last summer. I felt like it was like Swamp Thing with choir on acid, basically.
And what's really cool about it is, unlike, you know, the music that happens later in the game, it's not very, you know, region specific. It's just like, here's a big epic scene of a house on fire, could be anywhere. And so that's very cool. And I also want to mention that the audio team just received the award for outstanding sound editing in a game cinema from the National Academy of Video Game Trade Reviewers, which is fantastic. And I don't know if it was for this particular scene, but there are a lot of great scenes in the game, and I would love to know how closely you worked with the audio director to get the music to play so well with the audio.
Very close, for sure. There was a lot, especially I can speak to the prologue because it was coming online with the sound design the same time I was doing the music. And obviously, if you have anything that has a constant sound, so if you're talking about fire or a helicopter or a police car with the sirens running, you're immediately in a world of hurt for the music, because you've got to fight to have this stuff really be able to be heard over the cacophony. Then on top of that, you got to hear the dialogue. That's the number one thing. So we did go back and forth with mixes and things like that. And a lot of it was trying to get the balance of when things would kind of get big and swell, which a lot of times would be right before there was a cut or right before something important would happen in the house, and then kind of backing down for a minute, you know, for like 3 or 4 or 5 seconds, letting the music sort of tuck itself back underneath the sound design. And a lot of times you don't have that luxury because everything's happening in real time. You don't have control over when the character walks up and opens the door and something happens that's loud. a helicopter flies out or whatever, you know. It's got to be kind of dynamically mixed in the game engine itself. But it is nice when you have things like that that you can really key in on and kind of customize all the little ins and outs. And we had several sort of like set pieces like that, the very beginning, also the very end, and a couple in the middle that we focused on. So hopefully they listened to some of those, and that's what turned their ears on. I know the guys at Supermassive were very excited. Barney sent me quite the happy email this morning. And it's been forever since we've worked on it, of course, but that's the way this stuff always works. I remember, yeah, 30 years ago when I mixed that cinematic. Great!
Well, they were paying attention, so that was good.
Exactly.
Yeah. With the music in the world, did the audio team do anything to like tune the sounds, like the gnat sound that you hear with rustling in the undergrowth, or there's a bicycle that goes across a covered bridge and it's kind of squeaky and stuff. Did they tune any of that so it would, you know, dovetail nicely with the music?
I don't know specifically, but from the general conversations I had with Barney, everything was tuned that way. It was very, very deliberate and done from a pitch class sort of reference in terms of either coming up with a tonal center for the ambience itself, you know, the room that you're in, or if you're outside, like the wind's occupying a certain frequency, or if a car is going to drive by, and then incorporating the music as well. A lot of times the music was finished before the sound, so it was easier for them to kind of take my stems and play it in the game and then work against it. Well, I should say work with it. But when I say against, I mean, okay, the music's doing this. We're not going to do that right there. We're going to do this over here instead, so that it all dovetails together really nicely.
This is the second Dark Pictures anthology game that you've worked on for Supermassive. What makes these like artistically satisfying for you?
Going from modern day in the ocean and underwater and on a ghost ship to historically hundreds and hundreds of years before that in Salem with, you know, witches and trials and things like that. It's just in my head, all this sort of sonic imagery just pops into place already. And it's the kind of thing that is only made better because I've worked with Barney for so long now. I don't remember when Until Dawn came out, but I worked with him on that 3 years before it came out. I think it's been more than 10 years now that I've been working with him. It's the longest professional relationship I've had with anybody. And not by choice, it's just everybody ends up getting a different job, going to a different place. They're audio director for a while, then they're a producer maybe, or a bunch of guys that I was good friends with just got out of games. Some of them went into radio, some of them did some other things. Or they're just audio directors doing stuff that we haven't had a chance to work together again. So being able to do this with one person is just, it makes it so much more fun. I feel like I can be a lot more creative without being so paranoid about, is this the right thing? I can like take chances. Probably wouldn't have done the exact same kind of score for Little Hope if it was with a new audio director, because I know I wouldn't have sent that first piece that was just, I don't remember what it sounded like, but it was very bare and scratchy and like, I'm sure it was dramatic, but not the kind of thing where it just be like, hey, I know you know anything about me, but check this cue out that I wrote for you. I had the relationship with Barney, right? And I think we were talking about the previous game and I was like, just let me send you something. You know, you need something kind of like this. And I think I went over and like scratched the dulcimer or something. He goes, oh wait, that might be kind of interesting. So yeah, there's a comfort to be not underappreciated there when it comes to taking chances and, you know, being creative. And then of course you have to make this game that works on so many different levels. And we both learn so much after every one of these games and kind of hone in. Every single title is a new chance to try different sounds. And it's like I'm doing things that he was talking about on the previous game, and a lot of stuff he's doing things that I had talked about on the previous game. And we're reminding each other of ideas that we had before. Yeah, it's great because I've known him forever. I've been to his place. He's been to my place. We've been to like London and Nashville and Abbey Road and all these other places together. So it's really nice having that shared experience for sure.
Yeah, I bet. Because of course you want to be able to not only give your best work, but be adventurous and push the envelope and see what you can do that you haven't done before. And so it must be just great to know that you've got the support of somebody that you've worked with for so long that, you know, and they'll be honest. If you give him something that isn't going to work, I'm sure he would say that, but it just must be really great to work with somebody like that.
It really is. It's, and emails too. It's so nice. You know, I get with email, it can be very cold. So you need to say like, hey, Kate, comma, I hope you're doing well. I've found, you know, you gotta like list out all the stuff. I can literally just email Barney and say, sounded great. Like, and the subject is whatever the thing is that he sent me. We don't even sign our emails anymore. To me, that's the true, like, passing the threshold of friendship. If you don't have to say Jason at the end of the email.
Because he knows.
Yeah.
That's so great. You know, you've mentioned before about how much fun writing horror music is. And I'm just wondering, like, at the end of the day, how easy is it for you to just leave these terrifying sounds behind and just like close the studio door? Or are you still kind of mulling things over as you're heading down to join the family for dinner? Or I'm just wondering kind of what you do to sort of decompress.
Sure. Well, let's take a trip back down memory lane to like 2006, 2007, when I was first doing my first scary horror score for Dead Space. And I was so consumed with getting it right and it was so unconventional, both in the approach and the music for me personally, and from a technical standpoint. I was doing all these things with samples and kind of the stuff I was talking about, like I did with Mally, like that times 1,000. Instead of taking her voice in 2 minutes and putting it across the keyboard, I would spend basically 3 hours in the morning making all these orchestra sounds that I had recorded so I could play them on the keyboard, and then I would write a piece for the rest of the day. By the end of the day, I was completely fried, and it actually led me to drinking wine. I had never had any beer, wine, or alcohol, not for any, you know, social, political, religious, or anything reasons. It just never tasted good to me. And I remember just being so uptight and having sort of like the last part of what you just asked, carrying it with me downstairs and into the dining room and trying, just like feeling so tense. And I remember reading like, wine can help you relax and it pairs well with food. I was like, great. So I started, even though I didn't like it, I just started drinking a little bit of wine. I'd spend the last like 10 to 15 minutes of the day before dinner, I'd go get a glass of wine and I'd listen to some, like 60s, like early to mid 60s jazz that's tube mics in a room recording, you know, like a 5-piece band. And the trumpet's in the left speaker and the drums are in the right speaker. You know, all the panning's crazy, but it's just completely uncompressed, unprocessed, completely natural, and very, you know, open and relaxing. So I would drink my wine and I'd listen to jazz. And that was a long time ago. Now I just hit save and I go downstairs. I can turn it off. I think it's because I'm not as emotionally and kind of physically invested, because I've done it so many times before. Even if it's not stressing over violin sounds in the keyboard or whatever, I'm working with the hurdy-gurdy or the bowed psaltery. But it's just, I think part of it is I'm looking at the clock and I see that it's 4:30 and I want to wrap up by 5. So I start wrapping up, physically wrapping up the cue and mentally wrapping up, thinking about the cue. So by the time 5 o'clock rolls around, miraculously the cue's finished and I've hit save and I shut everything down and I leave. And if I have a talk like us today at 4 o'clock, by about 3:45, somehow that magically happens. Or if we're having dinner at 6 and I want to be finished by 6, somehow at 6 o'clock, the cue's finished. I mean, we're talking within like 60 seconds of whatever time it is that I want to have it done. But I've been doing it for 20 years now. So I think part of it is just my brain, you know, is cruise controlling in the background and knows when to turn it off, which is nice, instead of dreaming about it, which is what I used to do. It's like the worst thing ever. You don't want to work on horror music and then dream about working on horror music. That's like no rest.
that's the nightmare you can't wake up from, pretty much.
Exactly. I literally was living in a nightmare. Yeah, it was rough. But and I probably lost a couple of years off my life, but I learned so much. So there you go.
Wow, that's awesome. Well, it has been so much fun to catch up and really look under the hood with this incredible soundtrack. And Jason, it's always fun to talk with you, and I just really appreciate your time. So thanks so much.
Oh, it's always great to see and hear you, Kate. And of course, you have such insightful questions. I can't wait until we talk again.
Me too. Hopefully it'll be soon.
Yes.